think just, I think for the courtesy, why don't we just introduce ourselves real quickly for those of you who don't have name tags? Because we don't have the name tags here. So I'll start to my far left.
I'm Jay Bozovich. Lane County Commissioner. No, I'm Pete Sorensen, Lane County Commissioner.
Jay Bozovich, Lane County Commissioner.
I thought I was Pete Sorensen. So I'm Sid Lycan, Lane County Commissioner.
Rob Handy, District 4.
I, Faye Stewart, I serve the East Lane County District.
Springfield District.
West Lane, obviously.
South Eugene, yeah. And West Lane.
All right, very good. All right, so we don't have adjustments to the agenda for this meeting, but I do want to make an announcement. There will be an adjustment to the agenda for tomorrow's meeting. I know many of you here to under public comment. As many of you know, the Port of Coos Bay actually made contact with me, the commissioner and the commissioner from the port, as well as the director, about putting forth a resolution and in support of their efforts. Received a call this morning from the port, and they're asking us now that if we could pull that resolution. And at this point in time, their reasoning is the fact that they don't have a project. I think that's the most important thing. I think people have jumped the gun here a little bit. And until there's some sort of letter of intent, they've asked us to pull it. That'll be on the adjustments to the agenda tomorrow. That's when the actual vote would come up. But I think for those of you who are here, we still would welcome your public comment. I think it's important because as the process goes through with the Port of Coos Bay, I think we have some reps here from the port as well, and I think they'd be interested in just to hear your comments as well. And because it may be a completely different project than maybe what's happening now, I don't know. That's really up to them and for that decision. So I just wanted to make that announcement to you that that's where we stand as far as tomorrow, then I'll bring that up with the board. So other than that, we'll get into public comment. We have several people wishing to speak today, and so I'll just call you and how we receive. I have Robert Fritzen, and I'm going to ask if you state your name and address for the record and limit your comments to 3 minutes or less. And then on deck, it looks like John Tipple. Hopefully I got that right.
I got a back injury, so I can't bend down.
We can hear you fine.
We can hear you just fine.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, I don't have a comment. What I have is the series of questions I'm going to bombard you when this thing does go through. So if Coos Bay can answer these further on down the road, or you can answer them further down the road, that's fine with me. And I have basically four.
Can you state your name?
Robert Fritson.
Thank you.
I am Chair Emeritus of Senior and Disabled Services Advocacy Committee. I'm one of Kay's worker bees. The first thing is, if it's not if or when a railroad comes, but if it comes, can they fix the bridge at Cushman, raise it up 4 feet so we don't have that problem going through it? Question two, if the trains come through, who's going to clean up the Soyuzla River from all the coal dust? Question three, has anybody talked to Kay about how much this increased patient load is going to happen to her agencies when she gets bombarded with all these the new respiratory illnesses? And four, which is more to you guys, is what kind of property tax relief are we going to get when our property values go in the tank because we can't sell our property because the coal train goes by 4 times a day? Those are my four questions.
Okay.
And when these come through, you'll probably see me again, and I'm going to ask them again.
Okay.
Okay? I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Next up, is it John Tipple? Did I say that right?
Yeah.
Okay, and then I think Fred, looks like Jaqua.
Jaco.
Okay, sorry about that.
So here's five copies, and that was prior to the resolution being rescinded. Okay, so being a homeowner in Dune City, my name is John Tipple, also a Lane County taxpayer. I do not want to hear and see coal trains in my backyard. I have concerns with impacts on local watersheds and air quality. It is also a great irony that the coal is on its way to Asia through Lane County will come back to us as pollution courtesy of the jet stream ocean acidification. The negative aspects of coal will greatly impact us both land globally. Its burning contributes to climate change, not a legacy I want to leave for future generations. Therefore, I had written this prior to the withdrawing the resolution, but I would like, before you vote on any resolution, to request that you hold a work session and a public hearing prior to voting on this critical issue. So that's my major concern, is that we get good input in this, an opportunity to air it out to the public. It's something that impacts me locally and everybody globally. Thank you.
Thank you. Fred Jaco, is it Jaco or Jaco?
Jaco.
Jaco. And then Kenny Bird on deck.
Well, thank you, Commissioners. I appreciate you guys taking the time to be here today and to hear my comments. My name is Fred Jaco. I'm the sales manager for American Bridge Manufacturing in Reedsport, and I've come to speak before you guys about the importance of the Coos Bay Rail Link to our business. American Bridge Company broke ground in Reedsport location in June of 2002, and we began operations there in March of 2003. And since that time, we've invested $25 million in buildings, infrastructure, and employment there, and have sold over $41 million in railroad, highway, and pedestrian bridge since our operations began. At the time this rail line was shut down in 2007, we had approximately 100 people employed, and 95% of our incoming freight and 40% of our outgoing traffic was shipped by rail. We had received all rail shipments from steel mills back in Delaware, Indiana, Arkansas, and others, and we shipped product out to projects all over the United States, including the Hoover Dam Bypass Bridge, an elevated intermodal yard in Chicago, and a bascule bridge we have in downtown Milwaukee, Wisconsin. After that shutdown, we could no longer receive materials directly to our plant by rail, and shipments were railed to Portland and trucked down to our plant, and that increased our shipping, our incoming shipping costs by 40%. At the time of the shutdown, from September 2007 to March of 2010, we did not land another contract. Only after we were able to start pricing according to the new cost structures, we were able to land any new contracts. And then once the line reopened in October of 2011, we were able to get those shipping costs back down and have since been competitive, even in this reduced construction market that still hasn't recovered since 2008. Right now, we were down, once the line shut down, we went from 100 to 10 shop employees and 7 front office employees. And we maintained that for one full year without any business at all. Once the line reopened in October 2011, we were able to bring some of that business back, and we now have 55 employees, several of whom actually live here in Florence, and we probably have another 10 in Western Wayne County as a whole. We've done bridge and building projects in Alaska, Oregon, California, and Nevada since the line reopened, and we are once again bidding work in all markets west of the Mississippi River because we can now ship to that market competitively. Our first incoming rail car we received in December of 2011, and since then we've received 20 plus cars of incoming material, including 3 that were delivered today. And the renewed access to rail service is one of the reasons we were able to land our second largest contract yet, the Dog Ranch Bridge project for the Portland to Milwaukee light rail expansion up in Portland. The service of this rail line is critical to our business for several reasons. One is that almost all domestic steel processing is east of the Mississippi River, and that's the bulk of the material that we use in our project. Without being able to ship it by rail, we would not be able to be cost competitive with our with other competitors in the region. Second, it's direct shipment from rail, by rail from our plant to Midwestern United States and other markets is critical to be able to have enough business to support our plant. And finally, shipment by rail allows us to pursue unique and special projects that we're unable to ship by truck. We have 2 tunnels restricting us, we have road limits restricting us, and the rail access makes it very important to be able to ship very heavy stuff. Our future is really tied to this rail line. It was one of the reasons why we selected the Bowen Island location in the first place. And the increased traffic on that line will greatly enhance the operations and allow us better access to the service. The Port of Coos Bay has made a great investment in the rail line to date. And that simply gets it operating. A much greater investment is needed to bring it back to a normal operating condition that should have been in place 15 years ago. And without opportunities for increased traffic, that investment cannot be made. So in closing, I just want to thank the board for its historic support of this realignment, and I hope that you guys continue that support by supporting the opportunities to develop additional traffic.
Thank you. So next we have Kenny Bird, and then we have, looks like John Nicaris on deck. If I pronounced that wrong, my apologies.
Hello. Thank you for this opportunity to speak. I represent small business owners.
You can state your name.
My name is Kenny Bird.
Thank
and
you.
I moved to Oregon from Florida 10 years ago because it was the most beautiful place I could choose in the United States. I could have moved anywhere. I'm an artist, and I came here because of its natural resources, and that's why I chose to buy a home, and I'm fixing up the home now, and it's near the tracks, and I'm also concerned about the property value and the toxic levels of coal dust and things that haven't been understood on the greater, not only on the environmental level, but also on the impact to our economy as far as property values and people like myself who would want to come here because it's beautiful and because there's, you know, things that are more valuable than shipping coal. Not only that, of course, we should know where it's going and what it's fueling. Is it going to fuel a Walmart? Is it going to hurt our economy to send fuel away? Is it going to fuel a war? We don't know these things. We're just sending fuel away. Where's it coming from? Mountaintop removal. What's it doing to those people? These decisions have to be thought about by someone, and I believe that we should be those people to do that, because no one else can do that for the earth or for the animals or for ourselves. And other than that, I believe fishing would also be a major problem for, you know, a loss in fishing revenue when mercury levels rise or other things happen, which these things are happening by other coal ports and other things, and we've decided in this country not to do these things and have lower standards for our environment, yet we ship it over as if it doesn't come back when snowpack on Mount Shasta is showing mercury levels that are accelerated and other industrial problems from, you know, we were concerned about radiation, you know, these things come right over. So I just wanted to bring these points up and make sure that they're at least being thought about and we're conscious of all the levels of these decisions for future generations. Thank you.
So next we have John, is it Nicaris?
Nykirk.
Oh, heck, I really messed that up, okay. And then I have David Petrie on deck.
My name is John Nykirk. I'm a resident north of North Bend. I wanted you commissioners to address the problem of not just the Siuslaw River, but all the tributaries running through the Pacific and the lakes that this rail line crosses. We have a problem with rail cars in this country. The Environmental Protection Agency has made some mandates which have been fought in court and ignored, saying industrialists say, well, it's impossible to keep these standards up. So we're going to have a trail of coal dust running from Colorado or the coal beds to Coos Bay, and it's going to totally pollute these creeks that it crosses and the rivers, which then influence the salmon habitat, the endangered species that are in those creeks. We're finally starting to have a turnaround from in our natural resource of salmon production, because the splash dam method of logging has been outlawed, and the government has done things of like putting gabions in the creeks to produce sandbars and spawning beds. This is all for naught if we're going to poison the water. We have to look at the overall scope of the world, as other people have stated, and see that this pollution caused by this burning of coal is going to be burned in countries where the smokestack scrubbers for taking pollutants out of it are not enforced or do not exist. And so we all live on the same planet Earth, and we should consider our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren. And finally, I have to say, as conservative
used to mean conserve. And so people that consider themselves conservative realize that we need to conserve our natural resources for this country. It isn't to ship it overseas. Right now there's a gas terminal slated for Coos Bay. It's another one of these projects where we're taking our natural resources, our natural energy dependence, and shipping it to nations in the Western Rim, a lot of those being communists. So what happened to the communist threat? It's totally vanished now. Remember, we all went to school where we had to hide under the desk because at any moment they were going to blow us up. And I mean, it's time that we went above it and said, hey, if you want to be conservative, conserve. Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have David Petrie, and then we have Richard Gross on deck.
Thank you. My name is David Petrie. I'm the founder of Coos Waterkeeper and a Coos tribesman. Coos Waterkeeper is the only cross-cultural waterkeeper in the United States, and I can speak for 102 chapters on six continents that were in opposition to coal extraction, export, and consumption. But the lens that I view this situation with is going to be different because I'm a tribes person. And knowing the pre-contact history of my ancestors, I'm enrolled in Coos, from the Coos Lumpa Sayusla, very similar histories. They lived in coexistence with their land because of their culture and their reverence for the land, knowing that it sustained them. And it sustained them for 10,000 years or more. And now, in 159 years and 1 month since the arrival of the dominant culture, that environment is 90% compromised. The fisheries are compromised even more than that. So in speaking to the environment that's remaining, I think it's intelligent that we focus on economic opportunities that fit into that environment without further compromising it and pushing us over that edge to where we won't recover. So it's incumbent upon all of us to think not only about the right now and the right here, because I talk with Crow tribal people, with Northern Cheyenne tribal people, and tribal people all the way to Coos Bay. Most of them in opposition to this, other than the tribes that have the coal in the contract. Pretty obvious why they do. But ultimately, you know, in thinking of the impact to the waterways, approximately 104 stream crossings between Junction City and Coos Bay, and then linking that to the harbor itself and the development that's necessary, and dredging the channel from 31 feet to 51 feet and widening it from 300 feet to 600 feet, as the Army Corps of Engineers stated, David Koch said that the Section 303 permit would require, the millions of tons of sediment that's loaded with toxic chemicals from 159 years of no regulations, a pulp mill that was situated on Sitka Dock within a mile of this site that actually shut down in 1972 because of the dead zones. Those toxins are going to be released into the water columns, into the oyster farms, into the shellfish, and further compromise the endangered species that are in that bay and that watershed. So, in speaking to that, in thinking about, we do need to revitalize an economy. Let's diversify the economy, grow an economy, and use better science and technology to save the environment.
Thank you. Next we have Richard Gross, and then we have Gene Curtis on deck.
I think we're coming into.
Could you state your name, please?
Yeah, Richard Gross.
Thank you.
I think we're coming into a time not similar to any other point in human history, where we are expected to look at this as a whole planet with integral systems and overlapping influences. Along with that, we're given the responsibility of realizing that it is a time where the future of the planet, in its healthy sense as we know it today, is being threatened. A great man once said that the best thing you can teach children is responsibility. I don't know if any of us learned this type of responsibility well enough as children to be able to consider planetary influences and each and every one of our dramatic acts as integral to those influences of the entire planet. It's a new time and a huge responsibility. There are 80,000 chemicals that have been approved by the EPA, which were never known, again, before the time, the modern time. Many of these chemicals have synergistic effects on each other, and it becomes a very complex nature. And this is nature too. It's the nature of chemicals. As is all of nature, is the nature of chemicals, an interplay between them, way beyond any of our comprehension. So we are being called with this task when we know all of this is so far beyond our understanding, of making big determinations as far as now and the future. I have two grandchildren. I'm speaking for them. Lead, cadmium, mercury. Coal dust carries all of these heavy metals. They all will blow out of the coal cars and have an influence on the aquatic life and the terrestrial life, and even on us. How? When? Too big a picture for us to begin to comprehend. Was that my time is up?
Yes.
Thank you.
You bet. Thank you. Next we have Gene Curtis, followed by Mary Stevens.
My name is Gene Curtis. I live on Stagecoach Road, Ellsworth home. The track by my house is about as far from here as those doors down there. And I know my quality of life is going to go in the dumper, plus my property values are going to go in the dumper. We moved down here 16 years ago for this quality of life, and it's going to be destroyed. They say two cars a day, or two trains a day, four trains a day, up to 10 trains a day. It's going to be a can opener, and it's going to spill on all of us. And I can't quite understand why we're even considering giving your stamp of approval. It might not be legal, might not be binding, but we have to oppose this travesty for our quality of life. That's all.
Okay. Thank you. Next we have Mary Stevens and Elise Hamner on deck.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much for allowing public comment on this. I'd like to cut to the chase and say I'm taking kind of a middle of the road look at this at the moment, which is something even 10 years ago I never would have imagined hearing myself come up with that approach. But frankly, I'm 65 now, and I've heard so much from both the right and the left, from the pro-industry and the ultra-pro-environment, that I think we're getting caught in a bind. And I would like to ask you to use the very diversity that sits on your board. There's a wide spectrum of experience here. Could you if necessary, just roll up your sleeves and take a good, honest, economic look at this project in terms of its economic impact on Lane County. You're going to hear all kinds of stuff over the next months and years about the environment, and you're going to hear the pro-industry stuff. How about the hardcore economic impact on Lane County? I think it is a well-known fact that property adjacent to industrial railroads tends to decrease in value over time. In a budget-conscious era, can we really afford to lose tax revenues to our county? Public safety is an issue. 70% of that budget comes out of our general revenues. Do we really want to see a decrease in revenues in this time frame? Thanks, guys.
Thank you. And next we have Elise Hamner and then Dave Sullivan on deck.
I'm Elise Hamner, and I'm the communications manager for the Oregon International Port of Coosa Bay. First, I'd like to thank you on behalf of the Port Commission and Port staff for your support of the port in its efforts to save and rehabilitate the Coosa Bay Rail Line. The Lane County Commission has been a strong partner since day one as the port pursued ownership of the rail line following its abrupt one-day notice closure in 2007. You were behind us and have been as we pursued and received grants from Connect Oregon, federal Tiger money, and we're well underway with our $31 million rehab of the rail line. Thanks to the help of our partners, including Lane County, on Thursday, the Port and Coosa Bay Rail Line celebrated our one-year anniversary of restoration of rail service. Over the past year, we've grown to 10 shippers. Four of them are here in Western Lane County, Seneca Sawmill Company, Swanson Brothers, American Laminators, and Roseboro Lumber. The Coosa Bay Rail Link now employs 12 people here in Lane County, Western Douglas, and Coos County. In the past year, we've moved more than 1,900 inbound and outbound rail cars, and we're on track to exceed our goals for 2012. So it's important to know that the Port of Coos Bay's rail line provides critical, cost-effective connections to the North American rail system for regional shippers and for our marine terminals. It's our region's connection also to global markets. Rail is the most efficient, safest way to move freight on land. It offers manufacturers a competitive transportation option. And remember, these are companies in Lane County that take, these four companies that I talked about, that take raw logs and manufacture those into value-added wood products. We're not exporting raw products from these companies. They're making manufacturing products. Rail has a positive impact in other ways on the environment and on highways. Every 1,000 rail cars that run on the Coosa Bay Rail Line remove 3,500 semis from highways. That translates into direct benefits, a direct decrease in accidents and wear and tear on our highways, and a direct decrease in greenhouse gas emissions. I want to focus on the $31 million rehab that's underway right now. First of all, half of that money when we started the rehab went to Oregon companies. 80% of the contracts actually went to Oregon companies, 50% to companies located in communities along our rail line. As we've started this next phase of work, we've hired a Washington company to come in and do the track repairs, and I don't know if you noticed them on your way down here today. Their employees are staying in motels, they're shopping in our stores, and they're eating in restaurants here locally. So that money comes directly back to our community. The rail line will be a much improved asset when we're done with our current repairs. Train speeds right now are 10 miles an hour. They'll increase to 25 and 40 miles per hour along sections of the line. That cuts the trip from Coosa Bay to Eugene from 2 days to 1 day. And still, when we're done, the Coosa Bay rail line will need another $60 million in long-term repairs. I guess to wrap it up, I want you to know that the port is pursuing interdependent projects with the long-term goal of putting private money back into the rail line, and we're hoping we can count on you as a continued partner in the future as we rehabilitate the rail line and help companies that exist in our communities. Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have Dave Sullivan.
Yeah, and my name's Dave Sullivan. I live in Florence. I don't have any vested interest in coal or Coos Bay or anything else. I heard so many negative remarks on coal and railroads, et cetera, I thought I'd throw my two cents in too. First of all, coal is carbon. It's not soluble in water. When it's mined, it's graded and washed. There's not coal dust flying all over the place, giving people black lung and like people like, and billions and billions of people have kept from freezing to death over the years by the use of coal. So it has its place on this earth and will continue to do so for many years. I think most important thing is many people here don't have work. A lot of kids go to sleep at night hungry. And this is an opportunity to increase the railroad in bulk discharge in Coos Bay to increase employment. That's what we need. Our employment in Lane County itself is, I think, it's around 9%, if I'm not mistaken. That's the official number, anyway. And it would be nice to see that around 3 or 4. Every little bit helps. And this particular project, increase of railroad activity, is only going to help this county. It's not going to change the world. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. And then finally, our final person signed up is Roland Tollefson.
Yeah, my name is Roland Tollefson, and I would like to bring up a few questions that I think all of you need to answer before you vote on anything. Number one is, I know it's going to create jobs in Coos Bay, but how many jobs is it going to create in Lane County? Number two is, how much value is going to be lost on the property in Lane County? Number three is, why do we have to have the coal and to get the railroad? We already have the railroad without the coal. We're already shipping stuff for American Bridge. We're already shipping stuff from Seneca Lumber. We don't need the coal cars. So I think, and last of all, what are you going to get out of it personally? Are you going to get increased contributions for your next run for office? Or are you just doing it where you think it's actually for the good of the people in Lane County? Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Is there anybody else wishing to testify in a public comment? I have two hands, so why don't we go here and then the gentleman in the back. If you want to come forward and please state your name. Good, please.
Well, my name is Delbert Phelps. I live here, of course. And I started in 1953 working in the timber industry. And you all know what happened to the timber industry in the 80s. Everybody was worried about saving the spotted owl. Well, we shut a big portion of that timber industry down. No logging on Forest Service lands, some logging in O&C lands, and a lot of logging on private lands. The numbers of the spotted owl haven't increased one iota. Their studies still show it hasn't increased, but by shutting all that logging down didn't help anything. So that was a worry that people had, supposedly based on scientific studies, that wasn't true. So here we now have another worry, concern about what coal dust will do along the railroad ways to the rivers and the homes that it passes by and so forth. That railroad was put in there in 1913, and it's served all kinds of uses for economic base to this county until the time it shut down. And now it's been reopened, thank goodness. We have another opportunity for economic benefit to Lane County. Not just in Coos Bay, those workers that work on that train, some will live on one end of the track in the Eugene area, some will live intermediately, some will live on the other end. But the things that it picks up some hauls are those workers and those companies that get to contribute and haul on that track also employ people. So I think before we get all so worried about something that we are afraid to say yes to it or no to it, we should have the proof in our hand. Has that coal dust actually harmed anybody along any of the rails that it now travels on? Do they have a scientific study or a group of scientific studies that to actually back that claim up? Do we have any scientific studies that say that, that the coal traveling along those lines in the Midwest, Wyoming, and those places along the Clearwater River and those rivers that it travels by has actually hurt those fish in that river? Has it hurt anything in those rivers?
Yeah.
I want to see the studies that say that, to back that up. Then we know how to address the situation better. But I, what I see, what I, what little I know about the situation right now, it's kind of like deja vu all over again for the industries in this area with a worry that may not exist. And I hope that you get the answers for those things before you say yay or nay. But it certainly will help. The, just the track being there is going to help our economy in Lane County. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, my name's Dan Rankin. I've lived in Florence area all my life. I live out Canary on the tracks. I've been there since 1978. My house is 85 feet from the tracks, and I hear the train every time it goes by. I feel the train every time it goes by. My concern is I run cattle on that land, and I cut hay there. I get, so I grow beef, and cows consume that, that grass. My concern is that the tracks aren't up to snuff for a coal train. I don't think the configuration of the corners on some of those corners are going to handle the length and the weight of the coal cars. Right over here on Cyboco Curve, it's called, which is just between, just across from Cushman. That is an ongoing problem for even the lighter weight cars that are going up through there today. So, I mean, you see the people repairing, putting in new ties. They're only replacing the ties that are cracked and that are broken. I've actually walked my section of tracks and see what they're doing there. They're coming to my place pretty soon. They're knocking out the rotten ties, putting in new ones. Well, the trestles that are there at my place are completely rotting. There's birds nesting in them. All the poles are rotten from the inside. My concern is that goes over creeks that are on my property, that are going in the river, that are going in the ocean. I think everybody has a good point here, but the configuration of the tracks, the way they're built, the trestles that is crossing, whether it be Florence or Reedsport or Coos Bay, I don't think your $30 million is going to be able to repair all that money and or all those tracks. So, you know, my two cents is that the coal train is going to put, I don't see it running four times a day. You got to pull off somewhere, and there's not even any pull-offs running that four trains a day. So, the concern is that the tracks aren't going to hold up. There's going to be derailment, possibly. And I just don't think it's a real good idea to have that much weight, that much coal going through here at Coos Bay when it seems to me it'd be easier to go through Portland Port that's already ready for that. So I don't know why they're coming to Coos Bay when they could just skip over to Portland and go out to Columbia if that's the way it's going to be. But anyway, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Okay, that concludes the.
One more back here.
No, I think he spoke earlier.
Oh. I spoke earlier. Oh. I have just a comment for the railroad. Well, we're not trying to shut down the railroad. We're just trying to shut down coal cars.
Well, no, I think, and you can address that to the port. So that'd be fine. One more person, okay?
Hello, my name is Allison. Thank you for letting us speak about this. I agree with the gentleman back there that we're not opposing trains or transporting wood or any other products that are non-toxic, but the coal is an issue for everyone. My problem with it is also the property values are going to be going down. Nobody's going to want to move to an area where there's constant coal trains and traffic and dust floating through the air. Nor is anybody going to want to start a business in an area. Therefore, tourism, also revenue for tourism is going to go down. Nobody's going to want to come visit a state that is has toxic fumes in the air, as well as constant trains going by. As far as your visual resource thing, you know, so nobody's going to want to look at mile-long coal trains while they're trying to look at beautiful vistas in Oregon. As far as like salmon fishing, you know, that's a huge income for Oregon as well. People enjoy salmon. I don't think we're going to be able to be eating our salmon anymore. It's already toxic, let alone adding fuel to the fire. I guess that's pretty much all. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, I think that concludes the public comment. I really want to say thank you very much. Really appreciate the fact that you took the time to come speak. And so we'll move on to item three, which is commissioner's response to public comment or and or other issues or remonstrance. And from the board, Mr. Sorensen.
I wanted to thank everybody for coming to our meeting here in Florence, and for those of you who presented public comment, I'd like to thank each and every one of you for giving your points of view on the items that you talked about. I'm glad to hear that the resolution isn't going to be heard tomorrow in the meeting, so that's a good development in my mind. I do think it's important to point out, and I think the representative from the port pointed this out, that for those of us that have been supportive of the rail link between the main Union Pacific line and the Port of Coos Bay, we do see some tremendous opportunities for commerce along that line. And I think that our support for the state to invest public money into that project, whether it's federal or state money, has been a good thing. My own concern is that we need to make sure that Oregon isn't a colony. And we're not just exporting resources like our logs and maybe like our Montana and Wyoming coal. We need to make sure that these are value-added products that are value-added in our own state, in at least in our own country. We need to make sure we're not a colony and we're just exporting the raw material as we have done in our past. So to me, the export of raw logs, the export of coal, this goes against the idea of building our economy here. And then also for those of us that have concerns about the impact of coal dust and the impact of coal dust, you know, this was kind of a shooting, moving target here, because we don't really have the proposal for what is actually going to be planned. And so the idea of having a work session so that whoever is proposing this could come and tell us a little bit more about it and we can learn more about it. I know that public health impacts are being studied by Multnomah County Health Department on their proposal up there. So I think we need to get a lot more information, and I just want to make it clear I am supportive of the rail link between the Port of Coos Bay, and it's not just because David Petrie and I went to the fourth grade together in Myrtle Point. It's because I think it makes sense for us as a state to have that rail link. But I do retain a very strong concern about the environment, the impact on fisheries and wildlife, and some of the other issues that were brought up today.
Mr. Handy?
Thank you, and thanks to everyone for coming down today and commenting during public comment. It's really good to be down here in Florence as a board again, and appreciate being here in the event center. And I'm glad that we've perhaps taken a step to slow down and learn more about this coal issue and the resolution that perhaps is getting pulled tomorrow. That said, I'd like to call on my colleagues to have a substitute resolution and for our Board of Commissioners to support Senator Merkley's effort to have a programmatic and comprehensive environmental impact statement looking at all of Oregon on this issue and making sure that we not only look at the public health impacts, but the economic development impacts, as well as the impacts on our watersheds, our streams, tributaries, and oceans. When we look at this, we really need to look at alternatives assessment. Our world has changed. We can no longer just ask the question, how much damage is safe? The question really is how little damage is possible? So I will be looking for our board to support that effort by Senator Merkley tomorrow. We'll discuss that some more. I also wanted to note that October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And in 2011, there were over 12,000 calls for help to domestic and sexual violence programs in Lane County. And like others, I believe all people have the right to live free of abuse and violence. So we'll be aware of those ongoing efforts too. Thanks everyone for coming out.
Thank you. And I just also want to thank everybody for coming out and giving public comment. I just want to address a couple things. It's interesting to note that this is Domestic Violence Prevention Awareness Month. One of the drivers of domestic violence and a driver of health concerns is poverty. As we look at Western Lane County with an unemployment rate of actually over 14% if you separate out Western Lane County from the rest of the county. And if you look at Coos Bay, where some of the schools have over 75% of the kids on reduced or free lunches, poverty is a great concern on the coast. And one of the things about this project and why Lane County was looking at the possibility of supporting it is its ability to start breaking that cycle of poverty on the coast. We're looking at a project that had the opportunity to employ 165 people directly, 59 people in induced jobs, and 61 people in indirect jobs in Coos Bay. And Coos Bay actually captures its employment area, actually reaches into Lane County. Think about how many people commute an hour or so to their jobs. It would be beneficial to the entire coast. They were looking at a payroll that was going to be over $36 million annually in the Central Oregon coast. That's a significant increase in income here. Why coal and why coal's needed to actually fix the rails was a question that came up. It's to have a long-term, high enough volume contract to be able to finance those improvements above the $30 million. They were looking at investing close to $180 million in the track. So that would deal with the issues of the person that's running cattle off Canary. So that's kind of why we're looking at this and why it was important to Lane County. A lot of people keep asking the question, it only looks like it benefits Coos Bay. This will have benefits on beyond Coos Bay. And if this project had moved forward and if we were to support this, it would leave us with a highly improved rail line, ready to ship almost anything, and a deep water port that Lane County therefore has access to and can compete in the global marketplace. I mean, people talk about we want to manufacture things here. We have to be able to ship them to the world that's going to buy them. And then there's some concern about us shipping our resources overseas or selling our resources. I'm certainly glad that Argentina, Mexico, and the Middle East don't think that way with oil right now or other products. We certainly buy a lot of products from other countries and bring their resources in here. And to try and think about it in reverse is a little bit, allowing the rest of the world to starve. 41% of the world's electricity is generated using coal. And that's a lot of people that are kept out of the third world conditions with that electricity. And if the real concern is about people, we need to think about transitioning off of that over time. It's not going to be easy. So I'm glad everybody came to talk. I understand the concerns. I think this is years away yet. There are technological advances. There's railroad improvements that have to happen long before that, port improvements. Years of construction, so this isn't going to happen tomorrow, and we're going to take some time and go back and look at this resolution, further at the request of the port. But I think it's very short-sighted to look at this and think it only benefits Coos Bay. It'll truly be an economic driver for the whole Central Oregon coast and for Lane County if this were to go through. And I just hope people can look at it that way. We can support the rail line, but we can't, support that rail line based on what's going to be shipped across it. At one point, that rail line, when the mills were in their heyday, was running over a train a day. past people's yards and all that. And apparently people were willing to purchase houses along that rail line then. I think if the technological advances and the tariffs that Union Pacific and Burlington Northern, tariffs or railroad rules on shipping, are placed on the coal where they're actually treating them for dust and all that, we can't really be selective about what goes across those rail lines, particularly mm-hmm. seeing we really don't have the ability to change that. We don't regulate the rails. But I just hope people can look at this a little bit broader as a as an economic opportunity for all of Wayne County and for all of the Central Oregon coast. Thank you.
Anything else?
Question, please?
No questions.
No, we're beyond that now, sir. Sorry.
Any questions?
No, and I just want to mention really quickly that, in fact, it was Mr. Phelps. I want to say thank you very much. I'm a fifth-generation Oregonian, and my family actually was in the timber business starting in about 1900, the mill up in Mullala. And between my grandfather, my aunts and uncles, and others, we probably employed close, well over 1,000 folks in this state and watched it go away. And so what I didn't hear is people don't seem to be offended by if, say, we ship wood pellets. So I think that was good to hear. And I think what's interesting as well right now as we speak, that Governor Kitzhaber is actually on a 10-day trade mission and to China and other Asian countries right now, trying to open up markets to see our products here from Oregon being shipped right there. So hopefully you're good with wood pellets. And I know I am. And I think that would be great. It'd also be good that if we can get some private sector opportunity and potentially some public money, but some private sector money to invest in the rail lines here. For me personally, I think that would be just outstanding, not only for Port of Coos Bay, but I will tell you it'd be outstanding for Lane County as well and our private sector businesses as well to have a deep water port right here that we can ship to, and as the governor's working diligently to open up those markets in our Asian markets. And I really thank Governor Kitzhaber for doing that. He's quite very, very good at doing this, and I'm pleased that he's in this position to be doing this as we speak. So again, thank you very much for coming out, and now we need to proceed with some of our business at hand. And so I don't think we have emergency business, and so we'll move on to the item at hand that's under Public Works, and it's a discussion and public comment to support the update of the Oregon Territory Sea Plan. The Department of Land Conservation and Development, DLCD, is collecting new information on the impact views and viewpoints along the coast as part of the visual resource inventory assessment. And we have Paul Claren here this afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you, members of the commission, Mr. Chair. My name is Paul Claren. I'm with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I'm the Marine Affairs Coordinator for the state. And as you already know, because we were here last year at an event in this very building talking about the Territorial Sea Plan, the amendment to it, specifically for designating areas for renewable energy development within the Territorial Sea. And what we're talking about today is a specific aspect of that planning process, and something that our department conducted pursuant to responses we got from coastal communities about the potential impacts to visual resources from renewable energy development in the Territorial Sea. So I'll just skip ahead in here. This is a picture of the draft framework for the Territorial Sea Plan that is now under consideration by the Territorial Sea Plan Advisory Committee and the Ocean Policy Advisory Council. This basic framework for the plan was developed by the Ocean Policy Advisory Council, which is a council made up of essentially stakeholders from up and down the coast, fishing communities, port people, local government people, conservation, environmental, and recreation folks. They came up with a general framework for a plan, and it essentially would create different areas in the state's territorial sea and manage them in different ways, starting with areas that would exclude renewable energy development because there are existing uses there like navigation channels, marine reserves, cable landings, things like that. conservation areas, areas where there are, conservation area would be an area where there is very high value fishing grounds and ecological resources that we'd want to protect. Management areas would have fewer conflicts of that sort, but still areas that have an area that would have fishing grounds and ecological resources of some consequence. Areas that we now call development areas, where we would prefer to see this new industry locate, and several sites that are already designated for that type of development, one down in Reedsport and another one up in Newport that is actually just a testing facility. So we're looking at these various areas and this issue about the visual impacts and also impacts to recreational areas came up. And through the planning process, we looked at those two issues and we decided that those need to be addressed on a area-wide basis. Mm-hmm. They're not issues that can be addressed through any kind of a zone in the ocean. They must apply everywhere. So we've been conducting this project for the past year, looking at the visual resources mm-hmm. of the Oregon coast and essentially going out and mapping and categorizing viewshed sites up and down the coast. And why don't you go forward on. So the visual impact analysis that we've been conducting for the past 6 months has really looked at sites up and down the coast in the planning phase to identify viewsheds. And these are areas that are public viewsheds, managed sites, the type that you'd find in a park, in any sort of public facility, even a county park. You know, you've got parking, you've got some sort of managed area where you can look upon the ocean. And we're talking about looking out into the ocean. We're not talking about the viewshed looking back on the land or on the beach. We're looking specifically out to the ocean. What would a project in the ocean look like from particular sites? So we've gone through this process of identifying, locating, mapping, and categorizing viewsheds up and down the coast to put that into the territorial sea plan. So the visual resource inventory goals was to first of all develop an inventory of these particular viewpoints, evaluate and score these various sites for visual quality, provide a basis for identifying areas of the greatest visual value because we recognize there are some areas that are iconic along the Oregon coast, sites like Cascade Head, Cape Perpetua, others, we call them postcard opportunities. Go ahead and fast forward. And we've been doing this project, working throughout the summer on into the fall. We just completed the inventory, in fact, just last week. Been working with local governments where we can, and with the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, which did all the assessment for viewpoints that were inside state parks, and that's the majority of the viewpoints themselves are in state parks. And an assessment team of folks from DLCD, OPRD, and county and city representatives who actually assisted us when we worked on the viewpoints that are in local jurisdictions. I myself participated in doing those viewshed assessments in Clatsop County and in Tillamook County. Andy Lanier, who's with me today, did them in most of the other areas on the coast, along with a team of other folks. And in every jurisdiction, we would invite local officials, elected officials, or people from the planning department to actually go through the training with us and participate in doing the viewshed assessment and identifying sites. So go ahead and fast forward. This is a map showing basically the number of sites on the Oregon coast, coastwide, I think 144 coastwide. So essentially, there isn't a place on the Oregon coast that is not covered by one of these viewshed sites. And if you were to put a project in just about any location on the Oregon coast, multiple sites would be able to see that project and would come into play. So the visual resource evaluation, I think I'm going to turn at this point, Andy's going to take over, and I'll be driving the PowerPoint, and he'll be talking about how we actually went about assessing the visual quality of each of these sites, and you know, how we actually went out there and inventoried the sites. So I'll take that, Andy. And you.
So thank you for having us today, Commissioners. I've been the project manager for DLCD on this bit of work, and I would like to emphasize that, you know, all of this was done in response to public angst with this issue. And so this is a system that we have come up with to help objectively evaluate the potential impacts of these things and do so in a way that can provide a context for decision making. The visual resource evaluation framework, if you look at that graphic, there's a planning phase on the left-hand side of the graphic. And then there's a project phase. And so the work that we are doing today, or that I'm reporting on today, is all kind of focused on that left-hand side of the graphic. So we've gone out, we've conducted the inventories, we've talked with the subcommittees of our advisory council about the issues of user sensitivity and some of the specific criteria when conducting an evaluation and determining a class and a standard that would be applied to any specific viewshed. So that's what we're focusing on today, and I'll go over how we did those. I'll run through a couple of examples of sites within Lane County to give you an idea of the results. And then, so when that inventory is completed and reviewed by the public, we will be taking that and incorporating it into the Territorial Sea Plan, and it will be used when any specific project comes to us. Go ahead, next. So when you go out and conduct an inventory from any one of these sites, you look at these basic categories, and I think there's one more, Paul. You start with looking at an assessment of the landform. So what is it that's looking at, that's in front of you? And you choose a point to the north and to the south from which to confine your assessment. So every place along the coast has a specific location and a bearing so that you know exactly what's in that field of view. And you basically go through and list and then score each one of these criteria. So landform, vegetation, water features, the color of what's there, the adjacent scenery, so what did you go through to get to that point, the scarcity, so how does this one particular place on the coast relate to the others, as well as any cultural modifications that occur within that viewshed. So this is a map of all of the sites in Lane County. It shows that they're sparser to the south than they are to the north, and that's partly a fact of the number of state parks that are in the northern half of the county. You guys know your boundaries pretty well, but the Cape Perpetua Overlook is kind of the if you think about it mentally, that's the northernmost point, and the Silk Coos beach access is the most southern. Next. So I'm going to take you through an example. So this is kind of would be like a virtual assessment for you guys. And the first one is at Neptune State Park, Strawberry Hill, and it's the point right next to that little piece of text that you see. So it's above kind of a rocky outcropping on the edge of that pretty dramatic cliff face. Go ahead, Paul. So if you look at the information that's present within these assessments, it really tries to capture the baseline of what's there so that when somebody is looking at this later, they understand everything that was seen and how it was evaluated. And so, you know, for Neptune State Park, you know, you have multiple points of land to the north and south with a really diverse rocky shoreline. You can get into the geomorphological terminology if you want. And then you evaluate based upon a specific scale for each number, basically how complex or how non-complex that is. And so in this case, a landform was scored 4 out of a 0, out of a 1 to 5 category. Likewise, you have vegetation scores. So, you know, vegetation really focused on kind of the diversity of types, forms, and textures that you would find in the environment. So this site scored really highly in that you had not only intertidal vegetation, but you had sandy or grass that grows adjacent to the shore, backed by really old growth Sitka spruce forest next. So that scored pretty highly on that feature. Now the water features is one example where this system, which we adapted from the Bureau of Land Management or the Forest Service, was modified for our purposes. And if you consider someone who might have been doing a visual scenic evaluation in a desert, a water feature would be a really distinctive component. So we modified that component in the territorial sea because everywhere you're seeing water. But in this category, it was what additional features are there? What besides a flat beach that you might look at is present? And so in this case, there were the wave on rock action was really important. There were multiple small coves that would funnel or channel the water in different ways, as well as tide pools or other isolated pools that were water features outside of a beach. So it rated highly in that category as well. The color of the environment in this location was also rated to be high, in that there was a wide diversity of blues and greens, lots of tans and browns, and so you can really, with these evaluations, get a sense of the depth and detail that's present at any one site. The adjacent scenery, if you look up behind you from Strawberry Hill, there's a somewhat primitive parking lot with stairs, an interpretive sign, but you are really on that edge of that intact coastal forest and that rocky bluff face. So it provides a pretty dramatic sense of scenery of where you are on the coast, which is what contributed to that high score. In scarcity, you had both the combination of landforms and interplay with the water features, as well as the context of that kind of wild and dramatic environment. And that's one of the things that contributed most to its scarcity. You also have the presence of marine mammals quite close a lot of the times because of those features. You didn't have any cultural modifications within the viewshed, so in this case there was no positive or negative effect of that class to this site. So if you total all of these sites up together, they have a final score at the end, and those scores then relate to a specific scenic quality evaluation of an A, B, or C. And
how come scarcity was 3 down below and 4 up above?
Just a typo when I did this last night.
I suggested you have to excuse me.
So I will make sure to fix that.
Is the total correct?
The total is correct.
Okay. So the total assumes a 4 for scarcity.
Yeah.
Not total incorrect.
So the next site is one with a little bit less visual diversity, the Saislaw South Jetty site. Here you had a much more homogeneous environment. You basically had the coastal floor dunes that were dominant in the near ground with, at the edge of your vision to the north and south, kind of coastal range foothills. You could also barely see the jetty in the distance. There wasn't much of a diversity of vegetation in this landscape, so most of it was a monoculture of the European beach grass, and there were a few beach succulents, so it was rated pretty low for that. There were no additional water features present within the viewshed, so there was no additional waves breaking on rocks or different types of surges. The colors at this site were relatively uniform and somewhat subdued, so they did not impact the user's experience in a very dramatic way. The adjacent scenery provided a lot of context, and it being at the top of the four dune with the river valley and the low-lying coastal dune environment was very distinct and added a lot to the sense of place. So it rated pretty well in that score. Next, I think we talked about that. So The South Jetty site, while it was distinct in the characteristics of that place, was also very similar to other locations nearby. So if you were at the Silkus Beach public access, this view shed was very similar to that experience. And all of these scores have verbal descriptions of what is a 3, what is a 5, what is a 0. So that's how the team of people who were out in the environment would talk about things and land on a score. The cultural aspect on this one got a -1.5, and that's because of the impact of regulatory signs and ATVs that were present running up and down the beach, as well as you could just barely see the jetty in the distance. And some people, in other circumstances, the presence of a jetty was actually enhanced, but at this distance, it didn't contribute much to the scene. So, and you have to excuse the name of the park down there, but the summary is for the Sykeslaw South Jetty. Again, so it was a much lower total.
Is this the one you're doing in the car on the way here?
Yes.
Yeah, there you go.
I got it.
As we're going around the pool,
yeah.
Curves.
So here is a list of the Lane County sites outside of parks and their scores. And this won't be very helpful to you, but one of the things that we are producing in accompaniment is a report that has each of the sites, a description of all of those features that resulted in different scores. And that will be provided in summary total. So there will be, in a week and a half's time, a draft document that has all 144 sites with all of the scores and descriptions associated with them. And that will be, I think, very helpful in looking back at this set of scores and sites. So there's the state park sites. And again, you'll see that the range is roughly from a 25 to a 9. So if you look at the next slide, Paul. So sites that had a 19 and above were scored A. Sites that had 12 to 18 were scored B, and sites below 12 were scored C. And so the standards associated with a class 1, 2, or 3 value that you see in this table would then be associated with the level of potential impact that is suggested for that location. So let me go to the next slide, which ties in the class with a score. So from the previous slide, if you had a class A site and you're very close to that site, then the object of that location would be to preserve the existing character of the landscape. It does not preclude very limited management activities. That means that something can happen there, but it has to have a very low impact, and that it must not attract attention when within that viewshed. The class 2 allows for a little bit more modification, and while it still means that we want the level of impact to be low, it's more than a class 1, and so forth, when you go down this list of the objectives for each class. Next.
I'll switch back to me, and I'll just do it from here. So when Andy talked about the impact, potential impact from a project, we have to remember that we don't know what kinds of devices might be out there. Right now, there are many different types of technologies that are being worked on worldwide. Some are based on the seafloor. You will never see them. You will never know they're there.
It looks like
those would never have visual impact. They would be sitting on the seafloor. Others are in the water column. Others are on the surface of the water. And others, like the wind towers that you've seen in Europe and on the East Coast, could rise 300 or 400 feet above the surface of the water. Obviously, they would have a very big impact. So what we're trying to do is have a very objectively driven review criteria that would look at any of those devices at the location where it is in terms of the various view sheds that would be affected, and then make a decision based on that. So as far as the review process goes, we're putting into the territorial sea plan a review process under the joint agency review team that involves the state agencies, invited federal agencies, local jurisdictions, and other affected parties. It would all be part of the joint agency review team, who together would actually do the analysis and determine what the visual impact would be. Now, the burden would be on the developer to provide us with a visualization of their particular development to the affected view sheds, okay? So they'd have to simulate what their project would look like from various vantage points along the coast, and then we would apply those criteria to evaluating it and making a decision about whether or not that project is subordinate in that environment. And so we've built a review process that actually involves local jurisdictions in the actual review and decision of that. In the draft plan that we have now, that's the way it would work. And so we would have the visual simulations that are done by the project company. We would do the contrast evaluation based on that, and the JARC team would together make the recommendation to the agencies about how to approve, deny, or condition the permit that would come from the state for that kind of proposal. Now, again, we're not going to be seeing this anytime soon. The industry isn't there. It's in a very early stage of testing and weeding out pretenders and finding out if any of these types of devices could produce electricity at an economic rate. And they don't have the investment right now that enables them to go commercial. So for a number of years, we're still going to be looking at testing devices, and we're probably not going to have to make a decision like this until we actually prove the technology and have money in the system to finance commercial development. But when we do, we'll be ready for it. And that's the process right now, is to put the plan in place so that when the day comes, we'll know how to do this. So that's what we call project phase. That's when we're actually faced with a project. And these are some of the degrees of contrast criteria that we would be applying to those various classes. So these are actually, you know, sort of the criteria that the evaluators would use when they're looking at these simulations to determine whether or not a project fits into the environment. You know, how much does it contrast with the background? You know, is it something that sticks out, or is it something that melts in, or is it something that's entirely invisible? And that's how you make your decision. So, again, project phase, and then, oops, I went back. So that's the degree of contrast. Those are the things that the evaluation team would actually use to make a decision about if a project works or not. So, next steps, we're in it right now. We're coming back to you, showing you what we've done in Lane County. We're bringing this to the Territorial Sea Plan Advisory Council Committee and to OPEC to get their approval to include it in the Territorial Sea Plan. We're going to incorporate those maps of all the view sheds into the Territorial Sea Plan and incorporate those standards into it so they can be used by the JARC when making a decision. And we're coming up with the summary report that Andy was talking about. So that's where we are. And again, there's going to be a lot of meetings coming up in the near future of TESPAC, the Territorial Sea Plan Advisory Committee, and its subcommittees over the next month, 2 months, and OPEC, and the Land Conservation and Development Commission eventually, hopefully in January, will be looking at the Territorial Sea Plan in its totality for adoption. So there will be work sessions that we'll be conducting up and down the coast at the beginning of November. One will be down in North Bend on November 1st, where we'll be going through the entire plan. This will be a public works section, session in the evening at the casino, I think from 5 to 8, on November 1st, where we'll be looking at the entire plan. This is a component of that, getting more public input on that, bringing it back to TESPAC. TESPAC will be collecting comments from the public at all of its meetings. Mm. So will OPEC, so will the commission. So there'll be a lot of opportunities for the public to weigh in on this as it goes forward.
Very good. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And not bad for being in the car, you know, and so not too many typos. That's actually, I'm really impressed with that.
It's,
so.
It's been a really busy time
yeah.
for us.
I bet it has. So is basically right now you're kind of a two-person operation, I guess, maybe in this area? Or is that how what's going on?
We have some additional help. We have a person at Parks. We have a hired contractor who's generating the report for us, who's just a temporary worker. But in general, on the territorial sea plan, Oregon is, we're doing it with a thin dime and a very small staff doing a lot of work towards the end of this process to try to get this thing wrapped up and done. And when you compare it to what other states like Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New York, other places have put into their processes, we're getting way cheap, but we're doing actually perhaps a better product. We've taken a long time to do this. We've gotten a lot of public input, and I think we have, in general, a very well-conceived, broadly-based plan going forward.
Well, that, I guess, maybe makes it more impressive. So we're quickly on the, just so you understand, I'd like to hear the joint review and also with the added component of the local. I appreciate that very much. And depending on, you know, as you move forward, and really, that would be really in the hands of our administrator, probably our plan management division leaders, is maybe who that person from representing Lane County would be a part of that, because I'm guessing you'd need much more technical being a part of this than some, you know, than elected officials. But you saying that, though, it rings well to my ears, and it's, I really do appreciate that very much.
Yeah, we have local officials like Terry Thompson, Commissioner mm-hmm. Lincoln County. We have Tim Josie, who's the chair of TESPAC, and Peter Hudelow from Clatsop County. Now, we made the language loose enough in the description of the JART that the counties and the cities can appoint who they want to participate in the JART. In some cases, like Peter Hudelow wants to be that person who participates in the JART, we actually trained him to do the visual impact assessment stuff. He was in the field with us doing it. So it's up to the jurisdiction
sure.
to send somebody. Their decision.
Yeah, that's great, though. Appreciate it. Questions? Commissioner Bozovich.
Thank you. Thanks for coming down, and it's great work. Looking over your scoring and having been to every one of those sites multiple times, I can't disagree with the scoring. You have my favorite places rated very highly. Every time I get somebody from out of town, out of state, or even out of the country, one of the first places I take them is Strawberry Hill. It definitely impresses people, and
the
picture, the number of photos I've been sent back from people that went to Strawberry Hill.
I noticed that the picture you had up there didn't do the site justice. It looked much better in the picture I was looking at on the screen.
I can spend hours there. Every time I go, it's a couple hour trip just to get playing in the tide pools, staring at the seals across that short little channel. I mean, you can get about as close as you can get to seals anywhere. Ever, seal pups and everything else. So it's a really great place, and of course the Hacienda Head Lighthouse. What an iconic postcard that place is.
Yeah.
So you definitely had the high points scored where they are, and I kind of got to agree. The South Jetty Beach is pretty much just the South Jetty Beach, but the North Jetty Beach scores higher because it doesn't have the ATVs on it.
Mm-hmm.
So
very
even similar,
though
very similar landscape, but very different. Different setting,
and
even though it has the impact of a little bit more development.
Sorry. Even though we didn't have the benefit of having you join us and help us do that, where we did have local officials and elected officials participate, get training, go out in the field with us, they came to the same types of conclusions.
Yeah.
They ended up being very objective about how they scored places even when they lived there.
Yeah.
Which was, that kind of proved the methodology right and proved that anyone could do this and do it the same way.
I just think it's a wonderful statement about our state that we are out in front of this industry and doing this assessment prior to having the demonstrations over not doing a project somewhere because they think it's got a visual impact and we don't have any objective data over which sites or anything, and we're going to have that all in our back pocket before the first project comes in, which I think is just an amazing foresight on the part of the state. And guys are doing great work, and it's going to really help in the future for any company looking to invest possibly along the Oregon coast, that there's some certainty if they pick the correct site, it's at least not the highest impact site. So I really appreciate the work you guys are doing.
Thank you. Anything else? Very
good.
Oh, good. Commissioner Handy?
Oh, thank you. And I appreciate the good work you're doing, too. That session we had last year when we were out here with folks with the C plan was just outstanding. I thought about it a lot, so it's good to have some follow-up here. Now, I think one of the questions that came up when this was launched was it was with dealing with the wave energy buoys. There was also a question about possibly looking at transmission stations that might need to be sited along the coastline too. Is this part of this consideration when you talk about developer projects?
If there was to be a facility that was built off on the beach or anywhere else other than the territorial sea, it's completely within the purview of the local jurisdiction to regulate and site that. The only technology that is currently being developed worldwide that would need such a facility is the aquamarine technology out of Scotland, and it's essentially looks like this laptop, except it's the size of a three-story house with a two-car garage. It's a very large thing that sits around the nearshore area, flaps up and down like that in the shore break, going like this, pumping water to the beach. And on the beach, you would have a traditional turbine generator power plant. All the rest of them just simply pipe electricity straight into the grid at a substation somewhere. So they would not require any sort of shoreside facility, just that one technology. But if there is a shoreside component, then it's a local jurisdiction and it's planned that dictates where and if that gets placed.
Okay.
If I may also add.
Yes, please.
Our inventories often included sections of the shoreline, and so they would provide a context for what's there as well. So when you were looking north and south, and from any particular place, we would often take a little bit on shore so that we would be able to have that context. And from that perspective, this inventory will be helpful in identifying what's already there or what cultural modifications have already been made to an environment so that you would be able to understand the context.
Okay, good. You mentioned that state agencies and local governments were involved with whether it be that they control the site or being involved with looking at this. It seems to me we have the U.S. Forest Service also as a stakeholder at various points along the coastline. What went into either having them involved or not involved with a project like this?
So we have been in communication with their planners. Our project lead, Paul Manson, has sent emails and had communication with both your Bureau of Land Management, because they own a fair amount of property on the coast, as well as the Forest Service. And so they are very aware of the inventories that we are working on and have conducted, and their planners will be looking at the results. And but we've heard nothing but good things from them that we are doing this. You know, they did not have the capacity to send somebody out to assist us in the field, although we did meet with one gentleman at the Yukon Head Lighthouse BLM property, and so he was able to talk with us then. But we have done the outreach, and we do have a person who sits on our advisory committee, Tim Barnes of BLM, who has been continuing to communicate with the other federal partners who may not be paying as close of attention to this process as he is. So they're keeping them appraised of our progress.
Okay. So that appraisal or reprisal is not yielding any barriers or some last-minute surprises?
No.
None expected.
Mm-hmm. No. They've been tracking this all along, and some of them participate even down to the subcommittee level, because we do all of our meetings as go-to meetings, so they can actually hear and see everything that we're doing at the meetings, and we have a lot of those folks who are online participating in our meetings as we go through them. And we also have NOAA, National Ocean Atmospheric Administration, who is our partner agency, who participates directly in this process and acts as a liaison for other federal agencies. Eventually, we have to submit the plan that Oregon adopts to NOAA for approval, and it will become a plan that both the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and all federal agencies must be consistent with in any decisions that they make. So this is not just a plan for the state of Oregon. It becomes a plan that all the federal agencies must comply with.
Two more questions. You mentioned, what I'll summarize is perhaps some lessons learned from East Coast states along the Atlantic. Can you give a high view of what we might have learned and how it's been applied to these processes?
I've been back to the East Coast, of Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and as you might have heard, a project called Cape Wind took about 10 years to site wind on about 20 miles offshore of Cape Cod, and I don't know how many hundreds of millions of dollars it was spent during that time, but the lesson learned there was to do something like this up front, because what they were fighting over and spending millions of dollars on was the visual impact assessment, and they were fighting folks from Cape Cod who have a lot of resources. So it took a long time, a lot of people spent a lot of money to finally get to a decision about that site. And now that's being repeated up and down the East Coast. So we want to get out ahead of that curve. They know very much what they're looking at. They're looking at one thing, and that's wind towers. We don't know what we're looking at yet. Like I said, this industry is nascent. We have no idea what kind of devices will be out there, but whatever it is, we'll be prepared for it.
Okay. Paul, did you want to talk about the BOEM process and how this may impact their process?
So we have the territorial sea plan applies to the territorial sea, which is the first 3 miles. We also have an agreement, a task force, between the state of Oregon and the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, which is the federal agency that now controls the Outer Continental Shelf and makes all the decisions about leasing and permitting energy of any sort, oil and gas, renewable. They're the successor to the Mineral Management Service. We have this task force, we're working with BOEM, and we hope that through that task force and through another process we are working with NOAA, we will extend our plan a little further offshore so that Oregon's interests are represented not just in the territorial sea, but in the Outer Continental Shelf. So decisions about wind on platforms further offshore can be influenced by Oregon's stated desire to act as ocean stewards. And that's written into the Oregon Ocean Resources Management Act, to Goal 19, and into the Territorial Sea Plan, that we have an ocean stewardship area, extends out into the continental shelf, and we'd like to very much see things happen there that are consistent with what we would ourselves do in the territorial sea.
Very, very, very thoughtful. Thanks for adding that. Lastly, I'm curious, I'm always curious about scoring systems and how they are derived, how you shake them out to have some balance to them. So fascinating. And along the line of Commissioner Bozovich's good comment about Strawberry Hill, I'm curious, you've got this rating system, Zero-to-5, actually must have gone through some pretty rigorous testing to come up with it. But then you have a minus 1.5 grade for something. One, why the heck are we doing that? Why isn't that just a zero? And if we're doing that, why can't Strawberry Hill get an A+, a 5.7, if we're going to bust the confines of the scoring system? What went into all of that negative scoring?
Each of the scorers has its from to scale. So, as you saw, the cultural modifications was the only score that had the capacity to influence in a negative direction. And again, all of these methods were derived and from the U.S. Bureau of Land Management and the U.S. Forest Service. And so, if you look back at kind of how they derived their scoring system initially, the cultural component was one of the things that really strongly affected people's perspective and their experience in a specific place. And so that's why I believe they have a negative 4 to a positive 2 rating on that particular scale. because if there are things that were really impactful present within the viewshed, and when you think about this in the terrestrial environment, you may be looking at the power substations on a landscape that maybe an otherwise desert environment, and that may be a very impactful or high contrast development within an environment that has low diversity in other ways. So that may have a really dramatic effect on someone's experience, and they felt like including that capacity of a negative in that category was accurate in how they did their scoring ratings.
Basically,
so
we put something there that detracted from the view.
Yeah.
Most places on the Oregon coast come out as a zero.
Yeah.
A few places where you have that iconic lighthouse, you're looking out from a particular location and you've got that iconic lighthouse, everybody considers that a plus. You give it a plus. Some places we've been, and this didn't make local folks very happy, you look out and you see on Pacific City Beach 200 cars parked on the beach. So between that site that they selected to look from and the ocean, there's a parking lot. That's a minus. I mean, there's no two ways around it. There's a minus. They want you to look past that at Proposal Rock or something, but hey, if you've got a couple hundred cars between you and that rock and they're all sitting on the beach, that's got to be a minus. And we did that to that viewshed, and we got to account for it when we do the scoring. It's not much of a minus, but, you know, what we do can be a plus or a minus. Most of the time, it's neutral.
And again, all of this is designed to help the decision makers down the road understand the context of that choice. And so what is truly the effect of a small set of buoys out in Pacific City that are a mile or two off when you do have 200 cars on the beach? Is it, I mean, in my perspective, maybe that's a relatively minimal impact relative to parking lot on the beach. So that's, again, we're just trying to provide that baseline, and we did use the accepted and up-to-date methodologies that the Forest Service and BLM are using, and so we're pushing the envelope in a way, because no one has done this for a planning area in the water yet, so we're going to have our growing pains in some ways, and hopefully and this will take into account all of the concerns that our citizens have voiced up and down the coast.
Hey, thanks for all your great work.
Great.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thanks very much. Really appreciate it. And so this time, because our next item is a time certain at 5:30, it's about 5:05. We will recess then.
Is there any public that you have to speak on?
Oh, that's right. It does call for public comment, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Sure. My apologies. Thanks for the reminder. So I guess that's the question. So the question I have is on this plan, on the particular plan we just discussed by DLCB, is there anybody from the public who wishes to comment? Doesn't look like it. Okay. Thanks for the reminder. So got into the plan. Something I forgot about. So. So why don't we take, why don't we recess till 5:30, so it gives us about 20 minutes, and we'll come back and take a seat ahead of the GD.